Hi, and welcome to Forecast, a show about climate science and climate scientists. I'm Mike White, Nature's editor for Climate Science. Well, as I mentioned last time, I did end up going to attend a meeting on climate and economy put on down at Stanford, organized by Francis Moore and Charlie Kolstad. And it was pretty interesting. I mean, it's still a small community. It's growing rapidly. A few years ago, it was just a handful of people. This meeting was specifically designed around the question of whether or not you can draw global conclusions from local data. So like I talked about last time, you know, you have this explosion of very localized data, and people are in the process of trying to figure out the best way to look at these very local data and the damage functions you might see there. In other words, how climate variations are affecting things like agricultural productivity or other things like that. And then from that, like how best to treat those data to try and then approximate the global solution, and then coming up with a global estimate of what kinds of damages or benefits climate change might be bringing. And then from that, ultimately, to get to the social cost of carbon. I didn't hear many people specifically saying that you couldn't do this, that you couldn't use local data. But there was definitely a hell of a level of debate. You know, compared to a geoscience meeting, this was like a knockdown, drag-out brawl. But apparently for The Economist, this was a very genteel and polite meeting. Really glad to have gone to that. Got to meet a few people there in addition to meeting. I knew Fran from before from the Berkeley Climate Change Economy lunch series, but I did get to meet Charlie Kolstad, who literally wrote the book on it. And Rob Mendelson was giving a talk, which was quite interesting. And Christopher Severin, I know Sol Shung from before on the podcast, and also his longtime colleague, Marshall Brooks. So I got a chance to meet a lot of people I hadn't met before, but had known through their papers or other activities. Just want to say to that community in particular, I appreciate the hospitality. I know that this is sort of a new area for Nature, and I appreciate you letting me come to these meetings and at least being willing to have chats with us about the work you're doing and the reviewing process at your journals and how we can work better with your community. So for today's episode, I'm talking with Rob Meyer from The Atlantic. He's writing a lot for the online portion of The Atlantic, but I thought I might take just a brief chance to, you know, for international readers to let you know what The Atlantic is all about. It's a magazine. It's really interesting. It's quite old. It used to be called The Atlantic Monthly. Now it's The Atlantic, publishing 10 times a year. And it covers just all aspects of American and world politics, sociology, culture, entertainment. So, you know, for example, just going through the most recent issue of The Atlantic, there's an article about Richard Spencer, a leader of the alt-right in the U.S., by one of his old high school, I wouldn't say friends, one of his old high school classmates. An article about a Google engineer who set the record for the highest parachute jump ever. And then this incredible article about a man from the Philippines who essentially grew up having a slave in his household and what that was like throughout her essentially entire life, having a child who turns out to be a psychopath, how Trump might destabilize the dollar, the drag queen RuPaul, the benefits of boredom, and, you know, a huge range of topics like that. So it's not any kind of one thing. It's designed to argue points from their intrinsic merits, not to have a particular advocacy point of view. The long-term motto of the magazine is of no party or clique. Although for the first time in a long time, The Atlantic came out against a presidential candidate. No surprise, it was against Trump. And Rob has been doing a lot of writing about climate for The Atlantic. And I thought his writing was really good, insightful, well-argued, well-presented with a good storyline, and came out of a couple of papers we had in Nature about Antarctica. So Rob and I get into that quite a bit. But mostly I was really just curious about Atlantic being one of the higher profile magazines in this space in America anyway. How do you get into the job? Just like how do you get into being a Nature editor? Once you're in, you know, what do you do? How do you select stories? How do you pitch those stories? What kind of background, if any, is actually required? And you know, Rob has a fascinating background. It turns out he's a music major. So how do you get from being a music major to writing about climate change for a magazine like The Atlantic? Otherwise, in a couple of weeks, I don't know, like 3 weeks or so, I'll be heading off to Maine, to the East Coast for 2 months, going to, as I mentioned before, a Gordon Conference on Geoengineering, a WCRP meeting on sea level rise in New York. And so far, I have visits lined up to Dartmouth, University of Vermont, and McGill University in Montreal. If you're around that area, like to get together, do please get in touch. And with that, here, let's get on to my interview with Rob Meyer from The Atlantic. Rob Meyer from The Atlantic, writing about technology and more recently, a lot about climate change. Rob, thank you for coming on Forecast today.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
I think about The Atlantic as being the cultural, political, social equivalent of Nature, in the sense that it's, at least for me, it's a magazine that's like Nature. It's at or near the top of the field in which it's trying to compete. It's in a fantastic magazine. And so maybe I can just begin with posing to you the question that we often get when we go out and give talks or go to meetings, which is, how do you end up being an employee, in your case, a writer for a magazine like The Atlantic?
Thanks. Thank you. First of all, I would agree. Certainly in that Nature, the top level of the publication that you're working in. So I have a really funny story in this regard. But, and I've been very lucky in kind of winding up here. The kind of shortest version of it is that back when I was in college, I really liked to procrastinate. And one of the things I did to procrastinate was that I spent time on Twitter. It turned out to be one of the best procrastination decisions I've ever made. This was at this point 7 years ago. And so it was kind of early Twitter. And because of that, there were a lot of journalists who had kind of discovered it and had moved on to it and were beginning to do the thing that journalists do on Twitter today, which is like kind of hang out there and make jokes and work through ideas. It was even kind of a more generous open place then than it is now because there were just fewer people. And there were a number of journalists thinking about technology and specifically like how technology interacted with liberal arts and how the current kind of California technology scene interacted with the arts and the humanities and, you know, society, that I found really interesting and that seemed to be getting at questions that at the time no one was really asking yet. And I just spent kind of a lot of time on Twitter, like talking to them, trying to be like a good member of that community, I guess, like not trying to be too annoying, but like thinking through things. I had a little blog and I wound up meeting my old editor, Alexis Madrigal, who at the time was editing the technology section for The Atlantic through Twitter. And he was getting at a lot of these questions in the online technology section for the magazine at that point. And we just got to be friends through Twitter, basically. And then he invited me to start freelancing for the magazine or for the website. And I did that for a little while. And then when I was ready to graduate, it was really good timing because The Atlantic was expanding at kind of just the right time. I was getting out of school and I had these relationships that I just lucked into through Twitter. And he offered for me to come join and work as a technology editor on the site. And that's how I wound up at The Atlantic.
Is that becoming more common now for people to come in through non-traditional means like Twitter, as opposed to going through traditional journalism schools and applying for jobs and going through what you might call like a historical process?
It's really hard for me to tell. I do think there's a lot more kind of people sneaking in the side than there used to be. I think that's partly because, you know, what has happened in journalism maybe after 2012 or 2013 is this like big expansion in the national publications. And they tend to be, I think, often welcoming of people who are coming in with like non-traditional resumes.
Are you thinking about publications like the New York Times and the Washington Post?
I mean, yeah, but I think even more than that, I mean like BuzzFeed, Vox.
Huffington Post,
yeah. Publications that are like have a mostly digital presence or like a digital-centered focus. I think they're a little more willing to take people in through the side.
Did you study journalism when you were in college?
I didn't. I was a music major, but I was really lucky in two respects. It's funny, I'm talking about my story, and there's a lot of ways in which, like, even getting a job now through Twitter, I think, is really hard, because Twitter is, like, a much different place than it used to be, and it's harder to kind of get access to people. But there's other ways in which my story is, like, hard to repeat, because I was just lucky in a couple of respects. One of them is that I was a music major at Northwestern, which is where Medill is. And like my last 2 years at school, I was spending as much time on a student publication as I was in music school. And so I had all the benefits of like having friends who were actually in journalism school and peers who were like in the, you know, planning to enter the industry, even though I did not actually, like, my course load wasn't related to that. And the second thing is, my grandfather was a journalist his entire life, and both my parents were journalists for about 7 or 8 years when I was a kid. So I've been kind of around journalism my whole life.
I was actually up at Northwestern a few months ago, January in Chicago. It was fantastic, and I was visiting Yero Axford, who does coronamid-based temperature reconstructions, and I met with a lot of other faculty. But I also did get a chance to meet with two of the journalism faculty up there, Abigail Forstner and Donna Leff, and they were chatting with me, asking me, well, like, what do you look for in a good Nature paper? And I said, well, you know, something that's new and important. I'd like to have a single main story that's compelling and relevant to a broader audience. And they said, oh, that's pretty much what we tell our journalism students to look for when they're thinking about covering a story. For you, coming from a music background, how, and then moving into the Atlantic, how did you come to understand the kinds of stories that you would choose to pursue and that would appeal to your audience? Did you go through any kind of a quasi-formal training process like that, or was it more on the fly?
I think I learned that kind of on the fly. And so I came out of school and was a technology reporter. And at the time, it was like kind of the peak of the innocent boom, like the first half of our current boom. And so there was just a lot of public interest in like what companies were doing. It hadn't gotten super consolidated yet. It seemed like a smart way to structure a story in the way we were at the velocity we were working was like a story and then an idea. You have a story you can explain in three paragraphs and then a kind of like a twist, you know, like the idea that kind of spins it out and lets you bring the lesson or like a component of the story, or maybe it's not even a component of the story. Maybe it's like a historical context from somewhere else that fits into this story to help people kind of look at the broader world around them.
A lot of your stories are focused largely on climate change itself and its direct impacts, but some of your work does touch on the policy implications or how policy affects climate change research. When you're thinking about how to handle those stories that are at the interface of climate and policy, how do you approach that and how do you decide to pitch it to the Atlantic's audience?
Recently, my reporting has actually been a little like kind of straighter than it usually is, because there's been just a ton of environmental policy stories with the Trump administration, and definitely like the way that we cover policy at the Atlantic is, or one of the ways we cover it is to kind of walk through how this happens, you know, to get, I think, the process level, but hopefully only a level of process that like a concerned citizen would care about. So if you want to know the processes that kind of determine the air you breathe at a good level so that you can start thinking about how to interact with them and maybe change them, that's the level that I try to present in the story.
Maybe I'm reading too much into what I think the Atlantic is trying to do, but I've always felt like the Atlantic has an interest in democracy and the perspective that the best way to have a functioning, vibrant democracy is to have a populace who is broadly aware of the political, social, cultural, economic issues that are shaping the current form of their democracy, but like without trying to be really prescriptive about what they think people should be doing.
I think that's a really good description. I mean, I think like one thing I really love about working here and something that I think distinguishes the Atlantic among a lot of other, especially when we started kind of being online a lot of the time. I feel like this has changed in part over the last, maybe even over the last year, but something that has always set us apart is like a belief in the good faith power of people, like the importance of kind of citizens acting in good faith and reading and finding out about the world to actually make democracy work. And that democracy by itself, democracy like in good faith and for the common good, these are things that it is worth being earnest about and worth valuing and worth treating seriously. And like part of the way you treat them seriously is to prepare the information environment so that people can be engaged in democracy.
I've always really disliked buffets. I mean, first of all, there are the obvious food safety issues about people sneezing all over your food potentially. But really the broader issue for me is that you have this vast array of food. You end up kind of picking and choosing from various, almost always dissatisfying items. And you end up having the feeling at the end that you haven't had a very satisfying meal. And I feel like covering the Trump administration on the environment and climate must be a little bit like having a buffet of bad news. And just the options are bewildering, vast, unending. When you're faced with this kind of swath of options, how do you even begin to go about choosing what of it to cover?
I mean, my first answer is that I think to the degree that I do this, I can't judge how it's going. But I would say that like from the experience of doing it, you're mostly trying to keep your head above water. Because, you know, in truth, it's not, if I write three or four things in a week, it's not that those were the only three or four things that I thought the Atlantic's readership should know about. It's that of the possible 8 or 12 things, especially during a policy heavy week, those were the 8 or 12 things that I could pick from. And I went after this four because it was what I had time to do, and like because I could see a quick way to finish one of the stories, or because I'd done reporting on one of the stories before and I could kind of start from where I left off on that. It's not like an enlightened kind of like process where I'm like, this will be the one that I pick. It's just a long marathon. I think there's so much coming out of the Trump administration that if you care about the environment is really alarming. They seem to care so much about both sending signals that are like significant policy changes, but also sending signals that are just kind of meant to infuriate the opposition.
For example, the ongoing attempts to delist national monuments.
Like with the delisting of national monuments, or like when they changed the images on the Department of the Interior website, you know, that's really frustrating. It reflects changes within the department. There will be one or two more salient things that they do every 2 weeks. And that's what I try to grab. And I try to work in, I think, focus on the policy that will have the greatest kind of like effect in terms of tons emitted or how it will shape the market.
On the topic of tons emitted, you've written recently about what kind of seems like a bit of good news, which is the failure of the Trump administration to roll back the rules on methane emissions associated with natural gas extraction and fracking. Can you talk about that particular case and how it made its way through the system, or actually didn't make its way through the system?
The Obama administration at the end of, near the end of its term in office, kind of in the last year, finally put out a rule, or finished the process of putting out a rule, that limited methane emissions from extraction projects on U.S. government-owned land.
So these would be the fugitive emissions associated with fracking that are produced at essentially all steps of the production process. And then if you incorporate all of those, you can have a situation in which the total integrated greenhouse gas effect of natural gas use, like it might be kind of similar to theoretically dirtier fuels like coal.
Exactly. And there's a lot of incentives that kind of get on site, and energy companies can emit a lot of methane because it's easy for them and it doesn't really increase their costs. And in fact, without ever selling that methane, they release it directly into the atmosphere, and then it has the greenhousing, like the super greenhousing powers that methane has. That was one of the 13 rules that when Trump took office, the Republican-controlled Congress looked at using the Congressional Review Act on. And the Congressional Review Act is this law from 1995 that was passed by bipartisan majorities that controls this really weird circumstance. It says if a law, I'm forgetting exactly when it takes effect, but basically if a law, if Congress wants to disapprove a rule, wants to cancel a rule that has been promulgated by an executive agency, then they can vote with a bare majority in both houses. And if then it goes to the president's desk and he signs it, then that rule is eliminated. And not only is that rule eliminated, but that executive agency can never issue a rule on that topic again.
Well, that sounds quite final.
Yeah, it leaves like a toxic residue. So if they had canceled this rule under the CRA, then it would have been really legally tricky for there to be a rule about fugitive methane emissions, or maybe even methane emissions at all, from BLM-controlled land, you know, which is mostly out west. And so that was a pretty big deal by itself.
Yeah.
Congress, I think 13 out of the 14 rules that they wanted to try to get rid of, they successfully got rid of. I mean, they were large rules, but they often had a constituency, and it was harder to see who the anti-constituency was. I mean, one of them allowed states to set up retirement accounts for basically small business employees, for businesses that were too small to have like a 401k situation. There was one that let you dump coal, the waste of coal mining, mine tailing, into mountain streams.
And that's fine now.
And now not only is that fine, but unless Congress passes a law, that will always be fine because a new administration can't come in and issue a rule about it. This was the first rule that it got passed by the House pretty early on in the session. The Senate was really letting it sit. Senator Collins announced he wouldn't vote for it. Senator Graham announced he wouldn't vote for it. And then it was Tuesday of last week. On Wednesday, they would have passed the deadline for being able to repeal this through CRA. McConnell put it up for a vote, and McCain voted against it.
A gadfly that he is.
Yeah, exactly. And he voted, I mean, it's one of the few times he's voted against the administration. And he voted against it, he said, basically because of that toxic property of the foreverness of it. Yeah, that once you remove a rule under the CRA, you can never issue a rule under it again. And some people speculated that he was doing it because he was mad at how McConnell was handling the Comey firing. It was an interesting kind of moment for, like, you know, Republican politics in D.C. But more importantly, it means that this rule will stay law at least for another year in unedited form that prevents all these methane emissions. And that is also kind of the first time that the government has told fracking emitters to start looking at all the places they might be leaking natural gas from their operations. And I mean, there's a lot of questions about how much they'll be able to stop those fugitive emissions. But they definitely won't start to stop them until there's a regulatory reason why they have to care about them. And so it does give these companies this regulatory reason to care about them, you know, at least for the next year. People expect the Department of Interior will try to review the rule, but then it'll be up for public comment and it has to go through a whole process again.
Which wouldn't be quick.
It's a lot slower than just removing it forever.
I think I first became of your work around the time that we had two papers come out in Nature about Antarctica and about surface water in Antarctica. And one of them was by Jonathan Kingslake, and they had done this big survey of Antarctica, and basically it came to the conclusion that, wow, there's lots of surface water all over the place. We didn't know that. And then Robin Bell had a paper about the Nansen ice shelf showing that this huge surface river is able to evacuate off a whole lot of water, dump it in a waterfall into the ocean, and that the surface water there might not have the same kind of destabilizing effects it has elsewhere in Antarctica. So they were like kind of in conflict, but not really. There was just more of a nuanced story. Johnny was saying there's lots of water. We don't know what it's doing necessarily. And Robin saying that we have a potentially protective surface water environment in the Nansen, but we don't really understand why it happens there, but it seems to be destructive in places like the Larsen. And I thought that you did a really nice job about trying to give a good discussion of the papers and talk about how they related to each other and what the overall implications were for Antarctica. And when you have those kind of papers that come out together like this, how do you work through them and try and put out that kind of a nuanced message?
So if I remember correctly, both of the papers were in the same issue.
Yeah, with the News and Views by Allison Banwell.
And I think the News and Views, and I think even the kind of blurb for both of them was compressed. So it talked about both of the papers together. So, I mean, first, I printed out both of the papers and read them. And, I mean, I was a music major, and so I actually...
Yeah, I mean, that is not an easy task to read these papers, even for people who are in the field. They can be exceptionally dense.
Like, it's such a skill, is the main thing I've been thinking lately, because it definitely in the past, like 6 months, just my speed at reading the papers has like gone a lot faster. And instead of, I think when you first start reading them, you'll like get to a paragraph and you'll be like, why is that paragraph there? Or like, what is that sentence doing? That like, we know what's in that sentence. And now it's kind of like, oh, I see what that sentence is doing. Or, you know, you'll see there was something in an abstract yesterday and it was like, it talked about how the dating was uranium thorium. And it was like, oh, okay, that's interesting. Like, I wonder why they went with that. And like, that's actually a little, you know, more approximate this way. And it was like, just like in the scan. And it was like, oh man, I'm getting better at reading these dense papers. So I, in this case, like, I remember reading both of them. I remember the conclusions of both being different, but they took kind of different views of like whether the water would help preserve the ice shelf or not. Or one of them had a specific conclusion and one of them was more ambivalent.
Right, because I think that the Kingsley paper couldn't really say whether or not the surface water that they saw was necessarily unusual or increasing or driving some of the changes that we've seen in Antarctica, but it's at least a possibility. It's a possible implication that this is a factor behind some of the recent accelerations.
Yeah, and if I didn't have that level of sophistication of the discrepancy, I was like, they're not really coming to the same takeaway here about what the water is. And partly that's because, like, when you start reading the studies, you know, you're looking for the takeaway for the audience. And in climate change, there is definitely one of the questions that you're always thinking about. Even if though it's a question that I try to avoid making the frame of every story, but one of the questions is like, is this thing going to be worse or is this going to be better than we expect? And the question of like, is the water going to make preserve ice shelves or destroy them? Like, gets right to that question. So that was definitely something I talked to both Kingsley and I think I emailed Robin Bell and I raised it directly with them. And kind of got their sense on what the discrepancy was. And it was funny because when I asked them for an account of what both of the papers said, their accounts did not equal each other, which was funny because they had worked on the same team. And so that, you know, this is not something like I'm going to turn into a focus of the story, but it does mean that there was a lot of, that it was still unclear kind of what exactly was going on. The other thing that I remember really strongly was the Bell paper had the great kind of scope of evidence in it. That went back and looked at like the early Antarctic expedition and used like field measurements and field notes from that to inform this waterfall had been there on the shelf for at least 100 years and just pulled out other written accounts of something like the waterfall from the kind of century of Antarctic exploration in between. And like as a writer, those are just, I mean, at least for me, that's the first thing I kind of gravitate to, because any kind of earth science story where you can show the scope of people interacting with this phenomenon across time is like immediately exciting to me and kind of immediately gets into like why earth science is a really interesting thing to cover and think about, you know, even if you're not involved in the field at all.
That's an interesting point because I've talked to Robin about that work, and it's a style of geoscience that really isn't done very often because she had to go, I think it was to the Scott Polar Archives, and go through all those old logbooks and all the historical records. So you have to be there in person. It requires a lot of library detective work that isn't really part of a toolbox of a lot of modern geoscience, which relies on remote sensing and other kinds of remote observations.
Exactly. And it ties into this. I mean, both of the papers, because the Kingslake paper, which was this water survey of Antarctica, like started with him looking at Google Earth for a while and being like, wow, there's no account kind of all these, of all this pooling. And so both the papers started, I think, with science being done in a way that I don't think a lot of people kind of think of science as usually happening, where it's almost closer to a detective story about reality than it is, you know, we went out into the field, we brought thermometers, we sat there with the thermometers, you know, this is what they saw, or like we typed these things into a computer, all of which are great. But the thinking and the expertise here is like a subject area expertise, but it's not kind of the, like the evidence especially is not out of the, you don't require an expert to analyze the evidence.
Maybe not to analyze. And I think Johnny told me at AGU that some of the work was done by, I think by an undergrad. I'm not sure about that, but they're both papers that are in this category of an interesting discovery that in itself doesn't really close the loop on clearly showing how these things are important for the really broader questions, but they're sufficiently interesting that it seems like they're probably going to kick off an intense research effort to understand how these things really matter or perhaps not matter for the bigger questions.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, the kind of touchstone for me for this, and I think definitely the first time where I remember seeing a study that did this, just informing so much other research that I looked at, is the Orphan Tsunami USGS study, where they had this looking at the Cascadia subduction zone, which they knew kind of from research went off every 300 years about, and yet they didn't really know the last time it had gone off, and people had, you know, Westerners had been in Cascadia basically after 1806, I think is when Lewis and Clark is, and there'd been no record of a major quake after that. And then going back and combining, you know, actual seismic observations and seismology about the fault itself with records from Japan, which received the tsunami that resulted from this giant subduction zone earthquake in the Pacific Northwest, with then stories about what would have been the initial tsunami hitting and just destroying indigenous communities that were preserved by indigenous communities, like putting all those together to the point where we can say, like, the earthquake hit on this day in December, you know, in 1703 at this time, using this huge data record that goes across cultures and that we can only really put together, like, at this moment in history, was so exciting. That was so cool. I mean, and then Catherine Schultz for the New Yorker went up and followed up in a story about it much later. And I think I had seen the study before that, but then seeing how people reacted to her story last year, kind of like only reinforced my sense that this sense of this observational work and this like cross-generational detective work that results in findings about how the climate system works and the Earth system just really like excites people in a way that makes them think deeper about the world.
Something else that can make people think more deeply about the world, or at least might, or I mean, I think people hope that it will, is the use of op-ed columnists in major newspapers to discuss these kinds of issues. And the New York Times, a little while ago now, but the New York Times made the decision to hire for their op-ed pages Brett Stevens, who was renowned for having various flavors of contrarian or denialist viewpoints on climate change, whatever you want to call it. And I think it blindsided and enraged a huge chunk of the climate science community. Can you talk first about who Brett Stevens is and a little bit about his background?
Yeah, absolutely. So Brett Stevens was a longtime editorial writer at the Wall Street Journal. He wrote a signed editorial for its op-ed page about a couple times a week. He's a conservative in foreign policy matters. He favors the use of military force. He didn't like a lot of Obama policies. And he also is, at least at the Wall Street Journal, had been had dismissed climate science. I mean, whatever term you want to use for someone who doesn't accept the reality of climate science, this is what he did.
And at least in the past, he's had a fairly cynical view of the motivations of climate science and people who are interested in climate science.
Yeah, exactly. So in 2008 and 2009, he wrote op-eds saying that now that climate change had been disproved by the hiatus, which is another can of worms, but to just fully paraphrase his argument, now that climate change has been disproved and has gone away, now we'll see, you know, environmentalists and the left have to go find another made-up invisible issue to get people to care about and to get people to accept more government regulation in their lives and, you know, to put us on the inevitable march toward communism. The next year he wrote about how climate change is like anti-Semitism or communism, something that is totalizing in its view, that it always has the same answer to our issues and to our problems. And he talked about all these reasons why it was wrong and comparable to these totalitarian schemes that he opposes. So in 2008, he said, last week marked the 20th anniversary of the mass hysteria phenomenon known as global warming. Much of the science has been discredited. And then in a different column the next year, he wrote, for the anti-Semite, the problems of the world can invariably be ascribed to the Jews, for the communist, to the capitalists. And as the list above suggests, global warming has become the fill-in-the-blank explanation for whatever happens to be the problem, he wrote. Later on, he would say, okay, well, there's been a tiny bit of warming, but we don't, you know, Paris is the worst idea, and we should do nothing about this. So he has this history of being among the more high-profile, aggressive opponents of not just doing anything about climate, not just climate policy, but climate science, period, and the findings of climate science and the conclusions and methodologies of climate science.
How would you compare Bret Stephens to other people on this overall sphere, like Pat Michaels, Anthony Watts, Judith Curry, or Stephen McIntyre?
In some ways, he's had the highest profile. Unlike the people who really go after climate change, it's like a full-time job. In some ways, all you need to kind of keep your audience of elite readers thinking that this isn't really something you need to worry about is like an extremely confident shot across the bow every so often that allows them to just ignore the rest of what they're hearing. Because the writers who they trust, who have these really high prestige positions, don't care at all. I mean, I think like something Naomi Oreskes is really good on is how you don't need to get the audience to agree with you that like much of the science behind climate change has been discredited. All you need to do is get them to think that there is an argument about whether the science behind climate change has been discredited. And that's enough, because at that point they won't support kind of aggressive policy, and they'll have no reason to press their politicians to support aggressive policy. There is another part to the Stevens saga, which is that he has emerged as one of the most aggressive conservative writers against Trump. So he was sitting at the Journal for, you know, the last 2 years. And as Trump kind of continued to advance and didn't receive a serious response from the Republican Party and then was adopted by the Republican Party, he was extremely opposed to this.
Yeah, he's been lobbing out nonstop grenades against Trump.
Exactly, exactly. And actually kind of came to be like a darling of the anti-Trump Twitter world, I think, because he would just toss out these extremely barbed grenades one column at a time at the administration. That's definitely a part of it. I mean, first of all, kind of like in the spirit of disclosure, the editorial page editor at the Times is actually the old editor-in-chief of The Atlantic.
Good to know.
I know him, and I haven't gotten a chance to talk to him about this decision, and I don't want to speculate too much about why he made this decision. My guess, though, is that the Times is always looking to balance out its editorial page. Now, right now, it has a ton of center-left writers and two conservatives, three if you include Stevens. And I think finding Stevens, who is this respected conservative in foreign policy circles who really opposes Trump, and getting him and elevating him to this platform where he could oppose Trump from the Times, I think that was probably very appealing to them. I think that as after Stevens was hired and his opinions about global warming kind of came to dominate the conversation about his hiring, and then he did an interview with Vox where he sketched kind of what he thinks about global warming now, that also wasn't really scientifically literate. He felt like he had to respond to that.
And he did. I mean, he was basically saying that the attacks he was receiving from the left were just like or worse than the attacks he was receiving from the right.
Right. He said that on Twitter, and he wrote like his first column, which I assume everyone has read who's listening. I mean, it's interesting because he does a good job of framing an argument so that there's very few kind of outright statements that are just untrue. But the entire framing and the argument I find really dishonest.
One of the framings he used was that because the Hillary Clinton campaign used a data forward approach to do their estimates and they were wrong, that therefore climate science is wrong about the levels of uncertainty in climate science.
Right. And part of that argument was like he was really annoyed that environmentalists talk about things that are probability based with a lot of certitude, like missing that so much of the fear about global warming is about the tail end of warming possibility. Right. What scares people are the probabilities.
There was a response from people like Mike Mann and Stefan Ramsdorf that you kind of would expect to see. And Stefan wrote a very impassioned letter in which he canceled his subscription to the New York Times. But what kind of surprised me was that there are people who are less in that space, like Adam Sobel from Lamont, writing a critical takedown of that first column. Well, I guess from your perspective, is the level of response that happened on Twitter and elsewhere, did that seem unusual to you from the climate science community?
I mean, it definitely seemed unusual. But on the other hand, I think people don't expect a story like that to run in the New York Times anymore. And so when it does run, there's a feeling that it has to be kind of a disproportionate response because of how much damage people are worried it could do otherwise, mm-hmm. and that people will just return to this article endlessly and cite it and share it with their friends as something surprising, or something like, maybe we're really overestimating this climate change thing. It's definitely the most spirited and loudest response I've seen to a piece of writing that casts doubt on like some of the central assumptions of climate mm-hmm. science. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, he cast out on some of the central assumptions of climate science and like some of the central findings and conclusions in the New York Times. So there's not a good scale here because it has not happened in a long time. Did you see the publisher sent a note to readers who canceled?
I did see that. That was surprising, but it was kind of a blow off.
It was kind of a blow off, but at the same time, it made me think. I mean, it kind of said like, look, we spend all this money on reporting. And also we have these op-ed columnists who like you shouldn't care about, or something. I mean, I'm oversimplifying. That mostly said to me that a lot of people canceled. That like the tactic of trying to send a signal that mm-hmm. this is off limits by canceling, by boycotting, like actually worked, because I think normally the Times would kind of shake something like that off. Now, I'm not of the view that people should cancel their subscriptions, mostly because I work for a publication and I'm like quite aware of all the ways that decisions are made about stories elsewhere in the publication. And there's not even like a recent example of this I can think of, but you're aware that it's a big publication and big stories go out that you didn't touch. And if people make subscriber decisions about that, it nonetheless affects your own income. So I think it's tricky, but it did kind of signal to me that a lot of people had canceled.
Something else that really caught a lot of interest in Twitter, but also scientifically, was a recent paper in Nature about the Great Barrier Reef and the really eye-popping levels of coral die-off that have been taking place. And you've written about that also recently, bringing up the point that even fairly small levels of warming are going to have potentially just catastrophic effects on the Great Barrier Reef, much less ocean acidification problems. And when you're writing about an issue that's like it's that big on a system that's that iconic, and the news seems so, it just seems so unremittingly bad, To what extent, or if at all, do you feel like the piece needs to have an upside, like a good story about humans still have choice and how much of this is actually going to take place, or is it just hopeless in those kinds of cases?
I guess I have two different thoughts on this. When I started actually covering climate science, I had a newsletter for a while. Mm-hmm. It was called Not Doomed Yet. And it was trying to get people, like, the premise of it was that if you actually look at climate change news, a lot of it's bad, but not all of mm-hmm. it's bad. And there's a lot of stuff that's good in terms of like how the trends are going. And so it's good for people to kind of actually let themselves face this news every week and sit down with it, because they'll find that while a lot of things are indeed ominous and really disturbing, things aren't as automatic as I think a lot of lay readers think yeah. they are. And use that then kind of like assumed apocalypticism to like write off actually getting invested in the issue and taking steps for the issue. And I think that's true for a lot of ecosystems and like a lot of places. Uh-huh. I think it's fine for us to be honest about that. I think one thing that has been really stuck out to me covering coral reefs is like there is not that level of good news about them out mm-hmm. there. This most recent paper used the approach to look at 1.5 C world, where they pull out all the model runs that end in a 1.5 C world and then just analyze those. I mean, even in the fifth percentile confidence interval for that study in the 1.5 C, an average year would have been 2016. So the absolute best case for that is a major bleaching event every other year. I think you do have to convey that in kind of the scale and anguish that it deserves. I've been thinking about this lately because I'm hitting kind of 2 years of covering climate change full time soon. And I had always cared a lot about it. I had and cared a lot about it as an issue. I was not as versed in some of the specific long running fights, but I knew they happened, and I knew some of the science. I think one of the things I feel like I've learned is even the people who study this problem every day, who sit down and like face the problem every day, don't know how to talk about its scale.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, like I remember talking with Ruth Gates, who leads the Coral Lab at the University mm-hmm. of Hawaii. She does communication about this. She studies it. She thinks about corals all the time. And she studies corals recovery, and that's something that is, you know, important. And if anything, is the kind of like hope in any of this. But we'll just have conversations, or we'll have interviews, and they'll have a lot of silent parts because it's really hard to express the scale and loss of what is going to happen. And the longer I've kind of been doing climate science reporting, I think on the issues where that is the facts, you know, I'm not a political operative, and it's not my job necessarily to get people. I think people should care, and I'm happy to argue to them why they should care, but it's not my job to tell them convenient facts and truths or half-truths that get them to take action. You know, it's my job to just tell them the state of the world, and then if the political folks who are separate from me are also able to motivate people to take action, that's fine and yeah. good. But that's not my job in this. And I think it's important that it be clear that that's not my job.
Well, Rob Meyer is doing a great job, and so is The Atlantic, about trying to discuss some of these important, difficult issues on climate science. And their interaction with like huge swath of society and politics. I really appreciate the work that you and The Atlantic are doing in this space and more broadly. I think it's a fantastic magazine, and I encourage anyone out there to check out Rob's writings on the topics. Rob, thank you so much.
Hey, thank you so much. That was really kind. We are trying to get it right. So it's nice to hear that people are reading.
Oh yeah.
Actually, it's always nice to hear. So thank you. Thank you so much. And thanks for having me on.
Thank you.
That was my interview with Rob Meyer from The Atlantic. Rob, thanks for coming on the show. Next time I'll be getting back with a climate scientist. It'll be Kao Turamali, who is at the University of Texas, Austin. Soon moving out to Brown, talking a lot about his background coming out of India and getting into geosciences. A lot about proxies, proxy uncertainty, proxy analysis, and a little bit about metal and comic books. Should be great. If you'd like the show, you can subscribe to it, getting notifications right away when it's available on iTunes, Google Play Music, and Stitcher, or your favorite podcast application. You can reach me at forecastpod@gmail.com. On Twitter, I'm at MWClimateSci. The show notes are at forecastpod.org. I'll talk to you soon.